Welcome to CrossLink Radio, and we are offering another episode of The Sugar Show today, and we're doing it in kind of not two parts, but in two halves, I guess. I'm recording this with Dr. John Peldiak, a general practice dentist, retired from Michigan, and we're recording this as a video, as a a webinar kind of a thing, and then I'm also going to be offering it as an audio only. So you can view this on YouTube if you like, or as part of the description there on crosslinkradio.com or Blog Talk Radio or Stitcher or any of the other outlets that we have the audio going to. So this episode is about the words of sugar. That is a really important thing. As I was going through listening to all of the interviews that I was doing with all of my sugar experts, a lot of weird terms started popping up, and I thought, you know, this is really important that we cover some of the descriptions of some of the words that are used in association with sugar. And that's probably word number one, so let's talk about that. So welcome, Dr. Peldiak, to CrossLink Radio and The Sugar Show.
It's great to be with you again.
Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun talking about sugar and building this this little series here has been really a gas. So, all right, so the term sugar, as we were making this, putting this show together, was it last week or so, suddenly it dawned on me that we're using sugar, the word sugar, inappropriately because we just say all sugar is bad, and really it's not all sugar. So let's talk about what is sugar first. Go ahead.
Right. Right. We got the definition posted up here. Any of the class of soluble crystalline, typically sweet-tasting carbohydrates found in living tissues, exemplified by certain sugars, glucose and sucrose. Glucose, of course, is our blood sugar, and sucrose is ordinary table sugar. And that's where we get mixed up right away, because sometimes we say sugar and we're just talking about ordinary table sugar. And sometimes when we talk about our sugar is bad, we're talking about our blood sugar, our sugar is too high, we're talking about glucose. If we're talking about the sugar on the tabletop, we're talking about sucrose. So right away we run into problems with these terms. So we're going to try to clarify all that with the show today.
Awesome. So let's talk about sugar is a type of carbohydrate, right? So that's kind of where we get derailed also, especially when we're talking from the dental aspect, because we just say no sugar, no sugar, no sugar, and then our patients are still eating bread and cereal and grains, and really sugar is a simple carbohydrate, right?
Right, exactly. We're talking about the simple carbohydrates. Those are the basic units of carbohydrates. A monosaccharide, which is the simplest unit, and the disaccharide, which is just two of the simple units linked together chemically. You can continue linking sugars together and form huge long chains. They're no longer called sugars. They're called things such as maltodextrin or starch. And there are different types of starches, different types of maltodextrins. And what we're going to find out is there's plenty of different types of sugars, too. So starting with just the most basic, we're talking about the monosaccharides, and the most common ones that we'll encounter are glucose, which is also our blood sugar, galactose, which is found in milk, and fructose, which is found in fruit and by itself, but also these can be linked together. You can link a glucose and a fructose together, and you get sucrose, which is the ordinary table sugar. And conversely, you can break that bond, the sucrose bond, and get glucose and fructose from it. So that's how it works. You can use these as building blocks. You can build them up. You can break them down. And you get a lot of different properties and characteristics just by arranging the size of these sugars, linking them up into large sizes. And then we'll find out as we go along that just changing the arrangement of the atoms within these sugars will get entirely different properties. some very really fascinating properties that we'll find out about as we go along.
Yeah, that was really something fun to learn about, all these different sugars that have really healthful benefits to them. So sugar, though, what you were telling me last week is like, well, for let's start here. It's the gold standard so far when we're talking about sweetness and just the term sugar in general. So let's start with that.
Right, exactly. Sucrose is generally the sugar we're talking about when we say sugar in the general sense. That's what we find on our tabletops. We find it in plenty of sweet foods. We like the taste of it. It has the ideal taste. It's almost like the ideal sweetness, the ideal flavor. We like the way it feels on our tongue, the way it we have a fairly quick onset of sweetness, and the sweetness fades away again fairly quickly. So that's sucrose. That's table sugar. That's what we're used to. And so that's the one we're going to compare the other sugars and sweeteners to see how close we can come taste-wise, and for that matter, functionally, too, to sugar, because sugar also supplies a lot of functions, such as bulk in different products, and we'll get into some of that later on, too. So how close are we going to approximate the flavor of sugar at an acceptable cost? Otherwise, what would be the sense to replace it at all? Well, maybe sugar has some downsides. Maybe sucrose sugar has some downsides. And those are the ones we're going to look at, too. Well, for us, of course, one of the prominent downsides of sugar is that it is the most harmful, potentially, to teeth and gums. Why is that? Because if you look at the diagram we have with the sucrose molecule, it's comprised of the two monosaccharides, glucose and fructose. The bond that joins those together is a fairly high energy bond, and bacteria can utilize that bond to get energy, and then they still have the monosaccharides, glucose and fructose left over that they can build into a meshwork of a plaque or biofilm that helps create the matrix that holds biofilm together, and can also latch onto proteins and fats down the line. But that's really interesting when you see we just start out with these basic monosaccharides, and you can combine them together to make sucrose, and you can break sucrose down to get energy from it and also still have the monosaccharides left over.
Yeah, it's really crazy when you start breaking everything down into its little components and finding out, like you said, I can't tell you how many times I talked about biofilm, but I never, you know, I never put that piece together that, it, yeah, the biofilm coating is a sugar also, and it's just amazing. What hides in your brain?
Generally, they'll tell us that the meshwork is largely comprised of glucans and fructans, which means just it's those basic units that are reassembled into a meshwork structure. So then it all depends on how they're bonded together, and you get different properties which are determined by the different bonds. But that's what we're starting with. It is very simple. We start with sucrose table sugar, and we get the most activity of the bacteria in the mouth and the most acid production in the mouth from that molecule.
Awesome. And you did mention our next topic here was bulk sweetener, and that sugar, sucrose sugar, is considered to be a bulk sweetener. And there's a pretty big distinction between bulk sweetener and non-bulk sweeteners. And when people are talking about sugars, especially in the context of this series, they often refer to the term bulk sweetener, and that's what regular table sugar is. And we also have a little list here of other bulk sweeteners, of which xylitol, my favorite, is listed here. So those are just carbohydrates that are used to provide sweetness and function with adding bulk to whatever you're trying to sweeten. I guess that's the short answer there.
Right, and there's some other properties that come along with bulk sweeteners, such as, that we'll touch on later, some will provide a texture or a creaminess to some products. So we're seeing something in addition to just sweetness. We're seeing that the bulk is important in all applications that don't involve just adding sweetener to water. So if you want to sweeten a soda pop or a power drink or whatever, you don't need a bulk sweetener for that, because the bulk sweeteners just take up space. So in anything that you make a product from, that were a solid product, if you bake it or make tablets out of it, you're going to need a bulking agent of some kind, whether it provides the same sweetness as sucrose or not. So if you look at this list we have, the only two that I see here that come close to sucrose as far as sweetness and bulk would be xylitol and tagatose, followed by maltitol, and then erythritol. So as you go down in sweetness, you're not supplying the same properties that sucrose has. Again, these can be compensated for when you do combinations, but we'll talk about that later also.
Mm-hmm. So I'm noticing here that bulk sweeteners can have the OL suffix and the OSE suffix and the ALT suffix. So does that matter? Can we make any distinctions based on those little suffixes there?
Basically, the bulk sweeteners are all considered carbohydrates in that same class, which are the sugars that we talked about, the mono and disaccharides.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you keep adding sugars, you go up to 3 sugars and 4 sugars, you'll have some sweetness in products. You may have heard of fructooligosaccharides. So the oligosaccharides are sort of the connection between sugars and starches. They're sort of that in-between size. Now, generally, they provide some sweetness, but you tend to lose sweetness as the molecule gets larger. So most of the bulk sweeteners we're talking about are sugars with the OSE ending, or polyols, or the sugar alcohols with the OL ending. And what those are sugars that have been chemically reduced. In other words, the most active chemical bond in the sugar molecule has been reduced to an OH, which is very non-reactive. So they're very similar to sugars. They're in that same category, but those are the sugar alcohols or polyols that taste sweet but are generally less reactive than sugars.
Okay.
Than the sugar.
So then the next thing then, the opposite of a bulk sweetener is a high-intensity sweetener. And those are interesting, and those are the ones that we hear a lot about. We don't hear a lot about xylitol, not like we do of aspartame and the cyclamates. I remember the cyclamates from the 1960s. Oh, my God, everybody was going to get cancer. Saccharin. Those kind of things get into the news a lot because they are – you only need a tiny little fleck, right, in order to sweeten a whole pile. So things like stevia as an intense sweetener is a natural intense sweetener, but you can't sell it because you only need a tiny little bit, so you have to add a little bit of the bulking agent to it in order to have, like, the little packets. So it's not... I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. The high-intensity sweeteners work well where the bulking agent is water. So that would work out. So that would work out well. However, where you need a solid product, then you need to add something else to them. You notice we have them divided by the way the boxes are colored into a natural and completely artificial high-intensity sweeteners. The artificial high-intensity sweeteners are generally the source of the controversy that you hear about. Some say that some of these are not metabolized by the human body, so they should be all right. But then again, we're looking in more and more, seeing that there are changes possibly with the microbiome using some of these high-intensity sweeteners. That very little is known about that so far. We will be looking more into that as we go along.
So the microbiome of the gut is what you're referring to. So did I just hear you say that stevia may alter the microbiome in the gut?
There is a possibility. Now, when we're talking about stevia, we're talking about the entire plant, the whole leaf,
mm-hmm.
and then there are components in the stevia plant that are intensely sweet. So that can be a difference also that people are not noticing. You have in the box of stevia and steviacide. It's the steviacides that are the sweet components and the ribosides. There are sweet components in the stevia plant. So there can be a difference between taking in the whole plant with all the components as opposed to taking in only these really minor components of the plant, but they're so intensely sweet, that's what we notice.
Mm. Okay.
By the way, the microbiome of the gut, we talk about that, begins in the mouth, so we need to know how it affects our oral microbiome, our oral biofilms. And really not a lot is known about some of these.
Yeah, they're not tested the same because you don't use them the same. Where you may use a tiny, you know, fraction of a gram of stevia to sweeten something to the same intensity as something sweetened with xylitol with a whole tablespoon, for instance, then, you know, it just seems as though there wouldn't be any effect at all because it's just a tiny amount. So,
and that was the belief until recently, and then some of these anomalous studies turn up, and you say, how could that be? We're just using these tiny, tiny yeah. little amounts of sweetener, whether it's artificial sweetener or some of the others, and you say, it does seem to have some influence, at least until we can replicate these studies and find out what's really going on.
Yeah. All right. So the next, well, this kind of goes right along with it, is the non-caloric artificial sweetener. So I found this picture online looking for non-caloric artificial sweeteners, and you can see that stevia and Trevia and stevia in the raw are listed here, but they are not artificial sweeteners, and they are the bulking agent isn't an artificial sweetener either, so that's something to pay attention to. What else can you
exactly.
tell us about that?
Well, these can be kind of confusing when we talk about these sweetener packets
mm-hmm.
because basically what they are is a combination of a high-intensity sweetener and a bulking agent. If that were the pure high-intensity sweetener, you wouldn't even be able to find it in the packet. There'd
right.
be so little of it. So it has to be blended with a bulking agent. So you have to consider both the high-intensity sweetener that's used and the bulking agent that's used along with it. Now, what's really confusing to some people, but it really makes sense if you think about it, that some of those packet sweeteners that people are used to, they think they're being sugar-free when they use those packets.
Yep.
But if you read the ingredients, you'll see that there might be a high-potency, high-intensity sweetener combined with a real sugar, like dextrose on the label, which is the same as D-glucose, which means you're just using a super-sweetened sugar. In other words, you'll get fewer calories from it, but if you're using it in a beverage, let's say, that you sip on all day long, you're still sipping on a dilute sugar solution, which is not safe for teeth. So be careful about the bulking agents, because you have to know that even if the high-intensity sweetener part of that packet is safe for teeth, maybe the bulking agent is not.
Wow, yeah, you just, you know... You got to read the label, and then you have to have a science degree on top of it. So I really appreciate you helping me go through this. I got a C in chemistry, so even though it's a high interest for me, I it still takes me a long time to put all these pieces together. But the Trevia I know is bulked with erythritol, and I don't think there's another sugar in the Trevia. But I think isn't Splenda the one that has like six ingredients on that little package? So you have to kind of, Know your suffixes, I guess.
And also notice that there it might be different for different applications. Some are sweeter than others. Mm. Some are have more bulking agent added so that you can use it in baking or cooking. So there's all sorts of ins and outs.
Yeah.
With these acidity sweeteners. And if they're in a powder form, you can be pretty sure that there is some bulking agent added to it, and you really need to check what the bulking agent is if you want to be safe for teeth.
All right. Speaking of safe, one of the interviews that I had with Dr. DeCock was talking about GRASS, and GRASS is an acronym that stands for Generally Regarded as Safe. This is how the FDA grandfathers in a lot of products, and it's not scary or bad or anything. It's not like they're allowing arsenic in as a food, but there is just a category that is generally regarded as safe, and that's where a lot of these sugars that we'll be talking about in the upcoming episodes are getting in on. Is that fair to say?
Right, because this is a process that has been speeded up a little bit over what was available in the past. Companies can present testing of products that where they've done the toxicology, and most of these ingredients that we're talking about in this GRASS category are naturally occurring, something that people have used for a long period of time in their diet that have been part of the diet. We just haven't really focused on them as ingredients. They possibly because they were too expensive, or we found a better way to purify or manufacture them where they're available now, and they just weren't available economically in the past, so it just wasn't a problem back then. So we're going to be seeing more and more of these unusual, can I put that in air quotes, unusual sugars, rare sugars that we really hadn't heard of before that will be in this GRASS category. They'll be generally recognized as safe. They'll be sugars that were part of our diet since the beginning. And it's just that now they're available at a reasonable cost where they can be put into foods or certain products, especially for particular reasons. And as we go along, we're going to see some amazing things of sugars that are going to help us lose weight, stay younger, maybe even help stop tooth decay.
I can't wait for those. It's that kind of stuff that made me just so interested to get some of the word out that, you know, you can't just say avoid sugar, which you've heard me say 8,000 times already, so I'm going to leave that go. But when you talk about removing wrinkles or reducing them, anti-sugars that take sugar out of your system, there's a commercial now about some fancy-schmancy medication that'll do that for diabetes patients. And, you know, it's got 10 seconds of content about what the drug will do for you, and then 50 seconds of all the harmful side effects that'll happen, which we don't find with these sugars. So I'm very excited about that kind of stuff.
Right. So this is going to open up a whole new area, and hopefully we'll be able to get the experts who are involved in this leading-edge research and get them on the program and tell us all about it, because it is very, very interesting and opens up a whole new world here.
Speaking of rare sugars and tooth decay and eliminating tooth decay, one of the things that has come up in the interviews is this idea of a food or sugar being tooth-friendly. And tooth-friendly is, did you tell me it was a branded thing in Europe? Is that where it is, or how does that work exactly?
Right. Right, the tooth-friendly logo, a product has to be tested and make sure that it does not cause acid production, that particular product can receive this logo, which indicates that it's safe for teeth. Of course, that's just in that particular product. Mm. So each product has to be tested individually.
So safe for teeth means that the sweeteners do one of two things. They either stop or interfere with biofilm formation, or they do not promote acid production. So xylitol fits into both of those categories. Sorbitol does not necessarily, although it is still it still has the tooth-friendly logo.
Right, because with sorbitol you'll get some acid production, but it won't drop below that critical. I believe they use 5.6 in the pH reading on the tooth-friendly testing. So you'll see different sugars, different polyols or sugar alcohols that will have different readings on the pH test. But as long as they don't drop below that critical reading where you get into the high enough acid concentration that will help dissolve minerals out of enamel, then it can be certified as tooth-friendly or safe for teeth. What we're looking at is the possibility that there are some sugars and sugar alcohols that, in addition to being tooth-friendly or safe for teeth, may actually have a positive influence. They may actually be good for teeth, and that's another exciting area that we're waiting for more information as we go along into the future of this.
I always like to say there's a distinction between good for teeth and not bad for teeth. So those are two categories that are going to be filling up further and further as we get to know more and more about these sugars.
Right, and that could be a little bit confusing. And that's why when we're advocating something like xylitol or erythritol now, that's also looking to be very promising as far as an anti-carogenic sweetener, that they have to be used a certain way to be considered anti-carogenic. In other words, a one-time use means it's not going to harm your teeth. But in order to do good for your teeth, you would have to use it in a certain pattern or a certain regimen. Mm-hmm. And so that's a distinction that people don't always appreciate. We don't always appreciate it either. But there's more possibilities now with the sugars and sugar alcohols that may actually have a positive benefit for teeth as opposed to just being not harmful.
So, Dr. Peldiak, now this is this tooth-friendly tested little icon, this little tooth with an umbrella over it, and it looks kind of cute and friendly. That's a European thing, or is that a not in the United States thing? Is it also in Japan and in Asia? And do we have anything like that here in the States that we can use to identify sugars or products that don't harm teeth?
Yeah, I'm not certain about the tooth-friendly label. It's it is a licensing agreement, so that certain products can carry that logo. It's a lot more recognized in Europe than it is here. Over in the United States, mostly we have the FDA, where you can make claims that this product does not contribute to tooth decay. So it remains to be seen how that's all going to develop over time, and with these new sweeteners and the new strategies, maybe we'll come up with something that would have a greater impact when people select products off the shelf.
Yeah, I hope so, because really when it gets right down to it, if you chewed on a piece of wax, like Ortho Wax or something like that, that's going to be... It could fall into the category of does not promote tooth decay. So I'd like something a little more definitive. So that kind of brings us to the idea of how much sugar and how is sugar measured, specifically with xylitol, because the most recent study that we have about dosage with xylitol is 6 to 10 grams a day to help reduce decay or stop decay or however you want to say it. But nobody knows what a gram is. So what is a gram and why do we have to know that?
Well, here we have a nice depiction of grams of sugar in different products. Each of those sugar cubes is one teaspoon of sugar which would be 4 grams. So a level teaspoon of sugar is 4 grams. A level teaspoon of xylitol, also just about 4 grams. So that's something you can hang your hat on. So when we're talking about how much xylitol is needed to be effective in preventing tooth decay, we're talking about a little more than a rounded teaspoon a day, or a level tablespoon a day would be 12 grams. So right in that range, between a teaspoon and a tablespoon, we're talking between 12 grams, 4 for a teaspoon, 12 for a tablespoon. That's really a very small amount, in ounces, grams. So we're talking really very small amount that's divided during the day. But if it's used strategically at the right time, such as in toothpaste, and then in chewing gum or tablets or sprays immediately after eating, after snacks, and help neutralize the drop in pH that you get with a sucrose product, we're still talking very small amounts. You can see how much sucrose you're getting in some of these products, which if you look at that sort of mountain of sugar cubes, and then realize that you can neutralize that with about only a couple of those sugar cubes of xylitol used properly during the day.
And it's so not just xylitol, right? I mean, all of the bulk sweeteners would be 4 grams in a teaspoon.
Just about, yeah. There's slight variations based on molecular weight, but just about. That's a good guideline to go by.
Okay.
And you know, when we're talking about some of these sweeteners that have a positive influence on teeth, generally we are talking about just small amounts. In other words, you don't have to equal the amount of sugar you eat with a non-cariogenic sweetener. So if you have, an ounce of sucrose sugar, you don't need an ounce of erythritol or xylitol to counter that.
Mm-hmm.
You just need a small amount. And hopefully we'll learn more about that with time, too, with some of these other sugars that might be an anti-sugar, or it's sort of like an antidote for sugar.
Right. I can't wait to know more about that.
All found in nature, by the way. These are not some lab creations. These are all found in nature.
It's crazy. Crazy what happens when you spend your time looking at natural things as compared to what you can manufacture in the lab. And now that we kind of been talking about teeth a little bit, let's talk about the hierarchy of cariogenicity, just so that we could use the absolute biggest words possible. So the sugars that cause the most decay down to the sugars that cause the least amount of decay. And really, if you look at dental decay as an indicator for overall health, you can kind of put that hierarchy into play with the rest of the body as well. And you have sucrose as being the sugar that causes the most decay.
Right, exactly. Sucrose has been shown over and over to be the number one culprit when it comes to disrupting the oral biofilm, because it supplies energy and it supplies the monosaccharides necessary to build up that protective meshwork that the biofilm thrives in. Plus, the monosaccharides that are left over from the sucrose digestion are still available for food. So if the bacteria go for a period of time and you're not introducing any new sugar, any new sucrose, any new foods, they can still live off the monosaccharides that they've packed away, both inside their cells, the intracellular sugars that they pack away, or outside the cells, which is part of that biofilm meshwork.
Mm-hmm.
So sucrose is particularly dangerous. It supplies energy and it supplies the monosaccharides necessary for building up the biofilm. So then we can go down the hierarchy to other sugars such as fructose and glucose, which also make an abundant amount of plaque, but don't supply quite as much energy as the sucrose does to make the the biofilm more active and more acidogenic, more acid-loving. So, in other words, if we could, here's a really bad example, and I hope people don't take this the wrong way, but let's put it out there anyhow. What would be worse for you, a soda pop with real sucrose sugar or a soda pop with high fructose corn syrup, as far as your teeth are concerned? Well, you know, there are those who would argue that metabolically you're doing more harm to your system with the fructose or the high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
But as far as teeth are concerned, the one that says contains pure natural cane sugar, which would be the sucrose, would actually be more harmful for your teeth.
Doggone it, there's no winning. We're back to the tap. Just water, water, water. So then after fructose come the other O sugars, right? And then we start talking about the polyols as being the least likely to cause cavities.
The other O sugars and some of those that we're finding out might even be somewhat predictive. We'll find out more about that with time. They just haven't really garnered that much interest in the dental research community because they're just not that prevalent in our food system, at least not yet, or in products that would utilize a non-carogenic O sugar. For example, we could take some sugars right now and make a toothpaste with them that would be no more carogenic and possibly less carogenic than the usual toothpaste that people buy off the shelf today. So there's going to be a wide variation in those, all the way from somewhat carogenic to anti-carogenic, and then we'd get down to the polyols, which are much less reactive in general than the sugars, than the O sugars. So they're going to have a smaller impact on acid production. They're going to supply much less energy to the bacteria. And that's generally how to look at it. The worst you can do for your teeth is the ordinary sucrose table sugar, and the best you can do for your teeth so far are the polyols, specifically the ones that have been tested the most would be erythritol and xylitol.
We need to write an article about this. I think that it's a cool term and that it'll turn dental people on, the hierarchy of carcinogenicity. I hope that's spelled right. All right. And, oh, yeah, I wanted to also mention that the polyols then are the ones that carry the tooth-friendly little icon there. So there, that's where we're at with that. So let's spend a second talking about molecular weight. You brought it up in another context, and it's really not something that we talk about ever. So why is it important when we're talking about sugar in general?
Well, there's different reasons for it. We'll get down to the monosaccharides and the polyols in a bit. But when we think about, everyone's familiar with the term complex carbohydrate and simple carbohydrate.
Right.
Relates to really, in literature, is molecular weight. The simple carbohydrates are small. They have lower molecular weights. The complex carbohydrates have high molecular weights. What it means in practical terms just doesn't pan out the same way, because you can have a high molecular weight starch, which is just composed of glucose molecules all linked together, that behave much like sugar. Once you chew it up and your enzymes start working on that starch in the mouth, it'll break down the sugar right on the teeth, mm-hmm. right back to the glucose molecules. So functionally, the molecular weight didn't have much meaning in that case. On the other hand, you can have starches that are, depending where they're bonded, that can be almost completely resistant to digestion. Then you have the fibers, which are resistant to digestion. So those are complex carbohydrates, but functionally much different than the white bread starch we just talked about, which breaks down the sugar almost immediately on the teeth. So there, in that sense, the molecular weight becomes a confusing issue because it's just about size, but it's not about functionality.
Right.
And also when you get down to these smaller molecules, then it gets a little more interesting because now you're talking about, for instance, you've got the meshwork there that
the soccer ball's trying to get through the net, yeah. It can't get through because, let's just use it as an example, its molecular weight is larger than the opening that's in that net. But a tennis ball would fly through it.
Right, so if you had a fiber-type material or a resistant starch, it's not going to contribute to that to the biofilm at all. It's going to bounce right off, and you're going to chew it up and digest it. It's not going to affect your teeth at all. As it gets down into your gut, it has to be broken down in order to be utilized, because if it stays that large, it'll never get through your intestines and never become food source for you. So in that case, the molecular weight matters, but is it broken down or isn't it? When you get down to these very small molecules, like xylitol or erythritol, there might be some advantage to have a very low molecular weight, because it will penetrate these areas. Now, if these molecules, like xylitol and erythritol, can't interfere with the biofilm, with the dental plaque, with the bacteria themselves within the biofilm, with a smaller molecular weight, they can penetrate easier. They can also penetrate the tooth surface easier. And if they have acting as a carrier for calcium ions, be able to remineralize the tooth better than a similar polyol with a higher molecular weight. So these are still hypothetical and theoretical ideas to a certain extent, and until this all gets tested out more thoroughly. But it certainly makes sense that different molecular weights are going to have different functionality and different behaviors. So right now, again, what we're looking at is the best polyols for teeth tend to be the lower molecular weight, the erythritol and the xylitol.
Awesome. So let's go back to building molecules for just a second, because one of the terms came up that kind of made me have a little nightmare about my chemistry teacher, isomer. So an isomer has nothing to do with ice at all. It's not even has anything to do with temperature, but it has something to do with building molecules, right? So when we're talking about, why do we have to talk about isomers?
Well, because you'll have these sugars with the same chemical formula, but if you have the same atoms and you put them together in a different way, you get different molecules. Even though they have the same formula, they're going to have different functionality. One way to consider this is that there can be a right-handed and a left-handed world, and you can have a right-handed molecule and you put a mirror up to it and you see its mirror image. That's not the same molecule, and it's not going to be metabolically or functionally the same. So you can have a complete mirror image, a mirror image isomer, or you can have isomers that just differ at one particular atom, where you have a group that's flipped over, right side or left side. So that's why we have such a wide array of different sugars that they all kind of look the same. How come they're not acting the same?
Yeah.
Because there's these tiny little molecular structural differences that change the functionality.
Wow, so we do need to know a little bit about that. And you touched on a couple of things there that I wanted to make sure we put into this little words of sugar, and that was the idea of a left-handed sugar. So that's a really cool term.
I remember that from several years ago. It was the same scientist who devised the Mars lander looking for life on Mars with bioluminescence. His name is Gilbert Levin. He's the same scientist who was intrigued by this idea of the mirror image sugars, that maybe if we just produced a mirror image of the sugar that we're used to, our bodies won't recognize it, and we won't. It, we won't result in contributing any calories. And the other thing is that maybe the bacteria won't recognize it. They won't make acid out of it. So he started working with these left-handed cherries, which again can be mirrored, the complete mirror image of the molecule, mm-hmm. which we have a picture of.
With glucose, the glucose picture?
And the deep glucose, you can just see that there's a mirror between them there. And it, or you can make a mirror image at one site, one of the carbons, and get a whole different molecule. So anyway, that's what happens. They first were working with this L-glucose, and it looked really promising. It was just like regular blood sugar, but our bodies didn't recognize it, so it wasn't contributing calories. But it wasn't very sweet. By the way, it was perfectly safe for teeth, and yeah. The bacteria didn't like it either. They went from that to essentially doing the isomers of fructose and came up with one that was really interesting, and I hope we'll be able to track down an expert who can talk about D-tagatose, which is very similar to fructose. And it tastes terrific. It tastes just like sugar. It's, all the testing showed it was completely safe for teeth, and it was capable of being metabolized, but at a very slow rate. Well, that sort of nothing ever happened with that, but now we're seeing similar molecules. And one that we'll talk about soon on a future show is allulose, and that's the same idea, where it's not a complete mirror image of the fructose molecule, but it's a mirror image at one of the sites. So these isomers become very interesting, very exciting as we explore the possibilities of the left-handed world.
So L-glucose, the left-handed glucose, left-handed sugar, is the isomer, the whole thing of it. Is that, I want to make sure I'm getting this right.
Right, yeah.
So it's not just a little part of it that's going to be called an isomer, it's the whole thing of it is an isomer of D-glucose.
Right.
Okay, all right. We're all going to have this glued into our heads at some point. And then...
Yeah, isomers. They're particular types of isomers called epimers, where it's just changed at one site, but they're still considered isomers.
Okay. And then what about osmolytes? One of the interviewers were talking about osmolytes and how are sugars used as osmolytes?
Well, it's osmolytes are help regulate water. One way to look at it is that some of our bodies, our body's proteins are sort of floating in this watery soup, and osmolytes can help protect the structure of some of these critical molecules that are in this watery type environment. One of the ones we mentioned here that you have mentioned is the trehalose, which again is a true sugar. Looks like it's being used more and more. So you might even see that in some food packages now, mostly in frozen foods, because it helps maintain the moisture and the structure of frozen foods, that when you thaw them out, they still have a more similar texture to the original. So osmolytes can be very protective, and it can enter into different aspects of food technology.
So it sounds like you're talking about freezer burn. So what you could be saying, and you'll correct me if I'm just making it up, is that when they make foods that are going to be frozen, they will choose a different kind of sugar or sweetener or whatever, sweetener I guess is a better word, that has more of an osmolytic tendency, and that will keep the freezer burn from happening?
Right, help control the water activity in a product and help keep the original texture from you know, that it had before it was frozen.
So that's why in some of these frozen dinners, you're not going to see regular sugar listed. You're going to see all of these weird sugars because it has a better osmolite kind of action.
Yeah, it might not be listed by name at all. It'll be under sugar. It could be under sugars or added sugars or in the carbohydrate breakdown, it'll have so many grams of carbohydrate, and out of that, so many grams of sugar. So you don't need very much of this particular sugar, this trehalose, you know, to be effective in frozen foods. Another one that they use quite a bit is sorbitol, which we'll get to in the next slide. We have about the hygroscopic. Mm-hmm. Again, the substance, to attract and hold moisture, to hold waters. So if we're thinking of toothpaste, the nice creamy consistency, we want that to stay creamy. We don't want it to harden up or crystallize. So some of that depends on the sweetener, the bulk sweetener, the sugar, that how is it maintaining that consistency? How is it holding water in a product? Again, another reason why we're using bulk sweeteners instead of high-intensity sweeteners, because the high-intensity sweeteners aren't producing the functionality that we get with bulk sweeteners, such as the being hygroscopic or being osmolytes.
Well, and that's where we start to see sugars in cosmetics, because they do attract water to them, and so they're using them in all different kinds of applications in the cosmetic world, which was a mind blower for me too. I'm like, why are you talking about, you know, makeup right now? So that's why they're using some of these sugars.
Exactly, and that's why we'll find out when we have our expert telling us about rhamnose and why it's used in cosmetic. And wrinkles.
Rhamnose. Oh, my gosh. And I'd like to point out that the word is hygroscopic. There is no such word, I found out, as hydroscopic. So it's H-Y-G-R-O for the people who aren't watching this video portion. So that'll make you look real smart if you talk about hygroscopic instead of hydroscopic. So there we go. Almost all of these sugars that we're talking about have this crystalline structure, and they're all sweet to varying degrees. The intense sugars, do they have a crystalline structure too, mostly?
No, they're all over the map. It just depends. Some of them are protein-based, amino acid-based, so they could be a powdery material when they're dry. Mm. So you could have a number of different natural forms of high-intensity sweeteners, and in synthesizing, you can get anything from crystalline salt to powder.
Excellent.
So they different types of forms.
So,
but also the bulking agent that you use with a high-intensity sweetener can be just about anything also.
Could it be salt?
Powdery. Yeah, sure.
I don't know. It's like cats and dogs. You always think of them as opposites, and salt and sugar seems opposite, and that they would add salt to make a sugar. That is bulking agent to sugar is kind of funny. Well, Dr. Paldiak, our time is pretty much up. Did we cover all the things that we thought we wanted to cover?
I think so. It seemed like we set it up pretty well, so that hopefully we'll be able to get our experts in to talk about these individual sugars and their remarkable properties, mm-hmm. and it'll be very exciting to line these up and see what we can accomplish here, looking at all the different possibilities available to us now.
In sugar. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just simply crazy. Thank you again so much, and we'll be talking again about other sugars as they come up, and I appreciate your time and efforts and energy towards this little project.
Thank you, Shirley. This is a lot of fun, and it's a way to go, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be a gas. I've been excited about this for quite some time. So there we have it. This is Shirley Gutkowski and Dr. John Paldiak signing off for our Sugar Show episode, talking about the words of sugar. Have a great rest of the day.